This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 298. Today we welcome Brett McCracken to the program to speak about navigating the space between legalism and liberty. Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 298. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be back with you for another excellent episode. We have with us today Jared Oliphant, who is a regional coordinator for Westminster Theological Seminary. He's working out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back to the program, Jared. It's great to have you on again as a contributor.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be on this one.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about today. We've got a great book lined up to talk about and also a great guest. We're welcoming to the program for the very first time, Brett McCracken, who is a Los Angeles-based writer and journalist. You may know him as the author of Hipster Christianity, When Church and Cool Collide, which was published by Baker back in 2010. But he's also written for a number of publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, CNN.com, the Princeton Theological Review, Books and Culture, Christianity Today, Relevant Magazine. He's all over the place, and well-deservedly so. And he speaks and lectures frequently at universities and churches and conferences around the country. Welcome to the program, Brett. It's great to have you.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brett also is a graduate of Wheaton College, and this comes out in his book as he walks us through a Christian approach to becoming a better consumer of culture. The book before us today is titled Gray Matters, Navigating the Space Between Legalism and Liberty. It's published by Baker Books. It's just a great book, and we're going to get to this in a moment. But first, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we ask you to visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. Thank you, everyone, for supporting us and helping us to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge, but we need your help to continue to do so. So visit us online today, and we ask especially that you consider becoming a monthly supporter, or those are the backbone of our support. Reformedforum.org/donate, and we thank you so much for your support of everything we do at Reformed Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, Brett, you've been on several different interviews and programs. You've even done some written interviews. I've taken notice of many, including the one you've done recently with Trevin Wax. Mm-hmm. This is a really important subject, especially for young people. And we think about the changing tides in Christianity and the culture wars that have been going on in recent decades. And you're trying here to provide a critical but yet a nuanced way to navigate the space between legalism and liberty. I want to ask you first how this book relates to your previous book, Hipster Christianity, and what are your general hopes for Christians who would pick this volume up?
Yeah, I would say that in terms of how it relates to Hipster Christianity, so Hipster Christianity was kind of just looking at the trend of younger evangelicals in different ways that they were rebelling or reacting against the culture wars and the connotations and the baggage that came along with the evangelical culture that many of them grew up within. And part of that reaction and part of what I talk about in Hipster Christianity is just that whole like pendulum swing, the other extreme, you know, where instead of being kind of fearful and antagonistic towards culture and media and entertainment, they now are embracing it and fully kind of consuming it. In different ways, you know, social justice, for example, is another area where they're reacting against maybe the connotations of evangelicals not caring so much about, you know, their communities and the issues and the problems facing the world and the poor and all of that. And so that became a newfound emphasis. And so the book Hipster Christianity was really just trying to take notice of this this big movement among younger evangelicals. And it ended up being kind of more specific to the hipster, quote unquote, Christian, which has a lot of other, you know, connotations of style and just being countercultural and esoteric in music choices and whatever. So, yeah, it was a, and then I think the book was also just a critique of, churches that were trying to, cash in on the currency of cool in efforts to retain younger, church members and keep them interested and engaged. And it, the book is kind of a critique of that mindset that, yeah. that cool is what's going to keep young people engaged. But Gray Matters, I think, is, so if hipster Christianity was more of like a diagnosis of a, what I see as maybe a problem in terms of this maybe pendulum swinging in the other direction, Gray Matters is really trying to wrestle with, okay, so if both extremes are problematic, both the one that young evangelicals are rebelling against when it comes to their relationship to culture, but also the extreme to which they're swinging, which is this, you know, kind of undiscernible difference between Christianity and culture, where it's all just kind of, you know, consuming anything and everything and not really having that critical distance and critical approach. If that's also problematic, then how do we think about what the middle ground is and what a healthy, nuanced approach to our relationship to culture as Christians might be?
Yeah, that's helpful. I should let the listeners know this book is divided into roughly four sections here that focus on different aspects of culture. It's just fascinating treatments of these different things and asking and raising questions that many Christians, I'm sure, have never thought about in great depth. The first is on eating, but then there's a section on listening, then watching, and then finally drinking. Now, as soon as I got into the eating section and thinking about food as a Christian, I thought that you were writing this chapter especially for my wife. And when we moved to Philadelphia, we would go to the Reading Terminal Market, and she would buy a lot of fresh food and started to get more critical about the food choices she would make. And that's kind of rubbed off on me a little bit. But sometimes you feel kind of like an oddball and you're wondering, well, why are you doing these things and how ought you to think about food and particularly food consumption and enjoyment as a Christian? And you open up and you go all the way back to creation. You speak about eating in the garden. Why do you think this is so significant? And also throughout the entire Bible, why is food really a centerpiece in many of the metaphors, but also the interactions that Christians have with one another and with God?
Mm, yeah. Well, I think going back to the garden, I mean, just the idea of a garden, I mean, it's a place of cultivating fruit and vegetables and food. And it's, you know, that if you think about Adam's task from day one, it was to be a gardener, basically. And food is our nourishment. It's what keeps our liveliness going. And it's a gift of creation, of the good creational order that God created. It's part of the natural order of things that he created, that we would eat, that it would be our nourishment. And, you know, just going back to the beginning and just the idea that, you know, God created it and said it was good. So I think we just have to start with that recognition of the goodness of creation. And what does that mean in terms of how we think about food and just all of creation and all of, you know, culture, which is a byproduct of creation? Do we trivialize it and just, you know, not really think about it at all? Or do we kind of give it that almost sacramental weight of like, okay, this is something that God has given us. This is a part of his good creation. So then what should our posture be in light of that?
Yeah, I found that really interesting. You briefly touch on to set the stage, almost like a biblical theology of food. And so, you know, pointing out how in the Adamic covenant, there was really a dietary law back then. It was you can eat here, but not here. Right. So food in the garden, yeah, was related to life. And then you also touch on coming out of the garden in the world of sin. You have Noah, the restrictions in not eating the blood. And obviously we have like the Levitical laws. And so I think it sets an important precedent that food does matter to the believer in a lot of different ways, and we can talk about the differences with Old Testament and New Testament, but just the general principle is that it's not insignificant. So that was a good point, I thought, and kind of a I'll touch on this and then leave it, but you call yourself a foodie, and so you obviously have an interest in this, even just from your own like cultural analysis. So a lot of things were coming together, I thought, that were helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the biggest, you know, when we think about the food laws and the dietary restrictions, and then onward into manna in the wilderness, and you know, food should always be something that is couched within a reverence and an awe of our Creator, and a humility almost of being kind of at the mercy of a Creator. I mean, that's what the manna episode in many ways is about. It's about, you know, food is not just something that we can control and like adopt and appropriate for our ends. It's something that we are given and we should receive in that humble way of like being in awe and reverence of this Creator God.
Yeah. You helpfully start to unfold many cautions and opportunities as in engaging with food. One is food as escapism, yielding to eating for connection. What do you mean by that, and how is it better to think about food as connecting you to other people rather than something you do to remove yourself from the world for a time?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think about food, it's really one of the only cultural habits or activities that all humans share in common, and it's really something that can bind us across communities and across cultures. You know, you can share a good meal with people from so many different backgrounds and walks of life, but if it's great food and it's, you know, a great environment, great conversation, it's really kind of a leveling thing. So yeah, I think to consume culture in any way, shape, or form in isolation, I just wonder, you know, if maybe the way we were created to be in community, you know, Adam was with Eve, and throughout the Bible, it seems like community is an important emphasis, and not just kind of our individualistic, yeah, like me and my, you know, my preferences and my wants. It seems like, you know, even in the New Testament, Paul's kind of urging Christians in terms of like what they can eat and what they can drink, to think about it in terms of those around them and the community around them. So I just think it also can become dangerous when we're making these decisions and we're adopting these postures of consumption in isolation. It can easily become something that becomes an escape and almost a substitute for that connection and those areas of our heart that we might be wanting to fill with food or with alcohol or other things that become an unhealthy habit. So
yeah, that's a theme that comes up throughout the book. You know, what does our cultural engagement say to our community, you know, and how are these things going to be received, and what benefit can these be for others? It really starts to reorient the way we think about things. One aspect is to totally indulge in food and to love all the aspects of it and overeat. You encouraged Christians to eat with restraint and point back to the manna and the quail in Exodus 16, as you've already alluded to. But another is this fault of thinking of food strictly as fuel. Rather than enjoying it and savoring it. How did your friendships and also your history with food really bring out to you this aspect that it can be a delight and that you can savor it rather than just treating it as something to get you to the next activity?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think part of me was a little hesitant to write that section of the book, just given the realities of global economics and in some parts of the world. You know, food is fuel, and it has to be just that. And there isn't the luxury of really thinking about food as anything more than just a fuel to survive by. Mm-hmm. But since this book, I think I'm writing, and I acknowledge this in a footnote in the beginning of the book, that I'm writing for kind of a Western, you know, middle class context. I think for us, like when we eat food, which most of us can afford more or less to eat, and it's something that we do three times or more a day, why not think about it as something to enjoy and to have as an activity of grace and thankfulness and, you know, just not just something to get us, you know, through the next few hours of our day and, you know, putting fuel in our body, just like we would stop at a gas station to fill our gas tank of our car. you know, why not, since we're going to do it anyway, why not adopt more of a posture of, okay, well, I'm going to try to enjoy this and get the most out of it and have it be an activity where I see kind of the beauty of God's creation and appreciate it in a deeper way.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. I think part of what we're talking about is even evidenced in the insane amount of food pictures that we see like on Facebook. I mean, it just the meals that are taken pictures of and then, you know, shared with everybody is just, I don't know, I find it kind of hilarious. So I think that at least evidences some kind of importance that, hey, this is great. I want to share it with other people. You know, you talked about community.
Right, right. Yeah, and there's, I mean, there's good and bad things about that whole like food fit photo phenomenon too. I sometimes wonder if like, you know, are you really like, are you more interested in like sharing that you're eating this than you are about eating it and enjoying it?
Yeah. I mean, like, and they're carefully posed and yeah.
Right, right. And I've been, I mean, I've done that myself.
Sure.
Like, 'cause when you love food and when you are super excited about some food, you know, you, I guess these days your impulse is to get out your camera phone and take a picture of it, you know, for good or ill. That's our culture and that's our habit.
Well, that's the case, obviously, with a lot of cultural activities, especially with music. If you go to a concert, you see so many hands in the air with the phones raised, wanting to capture and put it on Facebook or Twitter rather than really sit and enjoy the moment. I really appreciated your section here on listening. And you start off with a history, really, of Christian views of music, and particularly beginning kind of back with jazz. Can you let us know about this movement and shift that we've seen from Christians thinking about music in different ways, including or not including form and lyrics and those types of things?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this was a really interesting chapter for me to research and write about because so much has changed even in the last 60, 70 years in terms of just music in general and then how Christians have thought about pop music. If you go back to like jazz and those forms of music that were kind of the early like controversial genres of music for Christians in the early part of the 20th century, it really was the form. I mean, jazz, you know, doesn't have lyrics in most of it. But it's this kind of improvised, you know, wild, unruly form, which is what jazz is. It's kind of rebelling against meter and against this tightly controlled kind of metric manner of music. So I think that just form was unsettling for Christians, and it kind of like I feel like it it connoted kind of a looseness in a broader sense in terms of like a gateway almost to like other forms of vices. And it was had associations in the jazz age of drinking and flappers and licentiousness and all manner of vice. So I feel like jazz was at least in my understanding, it was kind of the nascent form of Christian fear of rock and pop music. So then that gives way to Elvis and the birth of like rock music in the 50s and 60s. And this is really when kind of the form of jazz is starting to be coupled with lyrics of rebellion and the teen culture is booming in the larger culture. And there's this sense of, you know, adults are losing control, losing their grip on forming their children in positive ways. And I mean, the baby boomer, the post-war era in general was this time of uncertainty and fear and culture. And Christians, I think, were worried that they were losing an influence. And they were in a lot of ways with youth culture. So, yeah. So with the birth of rock music becomes this moment where Christians retreat in a way and the posture becomes, well, you know, Christian youth shouldn't engage in that. So we can have separate, you know, Christian Youth for Christ, Billy Graham rallies where they're singing, you know, Christian songs. And so there were efforts early on to kind of create alternatives, recognizing that young people seem to like this style of music and this vibrant, exciting new electric guitar sound. And then what becomes interesting in the late 60s and 70s with the Jesus movement and the kind of hippies becoming Christians phenomenon is that, you know, these youth, these Christian youth who loved Jimi Hendrix and, you know, the Beatles and the Stones and these very secular rock bands, they became Christians and they changed a lot about their lives, but they wanted to retain that rock music. So,
right.
So thus Christian rock was born, and it looked and sounded in a lot of ways very much like the secular alternative. And so from that point on, for the next couple of decades, there's just these two divergent or almost like parallel paths where the Christian rock was doing very much the same thing that secular rock was doing,
yes.
Albeit maybe a few years behind, right? Like there's kind of this lagging of trend and lagging of whatever.
Or but, not doing it as well either. So in many cases.
Exactly. It's very imitative. It's very much, okay, Nirvana is a thing in this genre. So we need to have a Christian version of this.
Yes. Yeah. The copy or the equivalent that's right. Safe. So, yeah.
You know, thus the birth of Audio Adrenaline. Mm-hmm. So it became this like kind of sad, I think, but understandable history of, you know, Christians, you know, recognize the value and the beauty in these forms of music, but they felt compelled to separate from the secular culture and have Christian, you know, Christian quote unquote music industry. So, I mean, I don't want to belabor all of this too long, but I think the whole concept of quote unquote Christian music, it seemed to fall apart or start to be questioned a lot by young Christians in the later 20th century and the early 2000s, as I think we started to think about, well, you know, what exactly makes something Christian? Is it just like a certain number of mentions of Jesus in the lyrics? Is it the Christian, you know, is the artist have to be a quote unquote Christian?
Right.
So I think we kind of began to see the holes in this stark division and the sacred and secular division began to like, you know, seem a little iffy. So where we're at now is, I feel like a lot of, I don't know too many young Christian young people who, you know, exclusively listen to Christian music or even, you know, mostly listen to Christian music. It seems like there's just a broader appreciation of all music. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. The history that you unfold here, I thought was just fascinating. You start, you know, obviously, as you said, with the jazz, and there is a concern about form that the nature of the music itself was unchristian. That goes back even to the medieval time period where there were Christians that would not allow music written in a minor key in worship because it was sad and depressive and didn't exhibit a worshipful tone. But then this shift that goes to people not caring about form, but in fact actually trying to find Christian, you know, content to pour into the forms. And then you mentioned Chuck Colson and Nancy Piercy bringing back the idea that form's important. And we're left nowadays to wonder, as you've said, you know, how should Christians approach this? And one way that you bring in is through the theological categories of common grace. And but you have to balance that with the antithesis. And how do we approach culture with the understanding that there is a reflection of the divine in all of creation, although that can be done by individuals or created by individuals in different ways that either honor him or dishonor him. How do we understand as Christians the fact that something that might not be explicitly Christian or something that might not even be done by a Christian can still have some value for us in this world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Kuyper had his famous, Abraham Kuyper had his famous comment about, you know, there's not one square inch over the whole creation over which, you know, Christ doesn't claim as, you know, mine. So I think there's a sense in the Reformed tradition that, you know, all creation can be redeemed and be kind of brought to glorify the Creator God because of common grace, because there are indwelled kind of vestiges of you know, the creational good within every human being, you know, even as it's different from, you know, special grace or saving grace, common grace gives even the most secular person that kind of sensus divinitatis is called. This sense of the divine, this desire, this longing to want to, through art, through creation, kind of make sense and almost give expression to this divine sense within. So I think, and all of us can, I think, have experienced this. Like, how many of us have not had an experience, you know, in a secular music concert or a secular movie, or even in a, you know, looking at a painting or something by Kandinsky or Pollock or, I don't know, Rothko, where, you know, it's not Christian, it's not, the label Christian is not put on that. And maybe the artist wasn't at all Christian. They could be an atheist for all I know. But there's, I've had experiences where I just feel like, oh, there's something like sacred, something weighty that is being conveyed through this. And it's pulling at my heart. It's connecting with my own sensus divinitatis within me. And there's some common grace that is a currency with which we're communing, me and this secular artist. So I feel like that's an important posture for Christians to have, or to be open to the idea that, by God's grace, the best art is not relegated to Christians, right? Like he's given everyone, every person, every human who's created in his image, the ability to create beautiful things, and that can convey the truth and goodness and beauty of his character and his creation in spite of themselves. You know, they might be God haters. They might be like actually angry and atheistic in their posture towards God. But even some of them, you know, like in spite of themselves, have created things that I would call almost sacred.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking, it seems like there's just every few generations or so, a genre comes along where at least some within the Christian community are just, I don't know, trying to stay away from it and preaching to others to do the same. And so I think of jazz and rock and roll, and I'm particularly thinking of hip hop. That, I think, that and heavy metal, I think, in Christian circles are maybe at the top of people's don't listen to lists, again, in kind of fundamentalist circles, but still, I think it's prevalent. But I was wondering about your take. I started listening to hip hop like early 90s, and it was interesting that, you know, groups like NWA and some of the hardcore rap albums that came out were within a few years of like the grunge movement as well. So you had this like countercultural movement from a couple different genres, and then cut to today, there's a lot of debates going on hip hop, like Christian hip hop, whether, you know, Christian is a genre or not. That's often quoted. So I guess I was wondering your take on, have you entered into those conversations on hip hop, particularly whether it's okay to listen to it and what can you listen to, and those types of questions that people may be asking you?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right in pointing to hip hop and heavy metal as perhaps genres that are still a little bit, you know, like taboo or like, viewed in a more critical light from a lot of Christian standpoints. I think part of it is just the tone and the language and the nature of those genres tends to be a little, you know, pushing the envelope of just grittiness and edginess. And that's hard to stomach for a lot of people. And I think especially for Christians, you know, as we think about, you know, what is edifying, you know, everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. You know, what does that look like in terms of what we fill our ears with and what we fill our eyes with? So yeah, hip hop is, it's tricky because I think there's a lot of beauty and truth in it, and it's such a specific expression of a culture and a people, and it's so bound up within a narrative of just cultural expression in the history of black music, for example, and what that has looked like for centuries and where it's at now and how it can be such a moving and powerful expression. And a lot of hip hop is really smart, and it has really incisive cultural commentary within it. So I think there's value in it, and I'm a big hip hop fan. I listen to quite a bit of it, but yeah, I think there can be a difficulty because so a lot of it, while it may be quality and have great artistic value, a lot of it just has a lot of misogyny and celebration of vice. And I think it's just kind of a good case study in terms of the whole question of, you know, where does that line reside in terms of, okay, something is artistic and it's telling truth and it's a valid artistic expression, but at what point does it become too problematic to listen to? And I mean, I think Christian hip hop is an interesting thing. I'm a fan of some of it and not so much a fan of some of it as well, but just for the same reasons that I feel like it can be imitative and derivative, and a lot of people critique Christian hip hop because it kind of removes like the very essence of hip hop, which is this kind of like unsettling, like this kind of destabilizing of the middle class kind of comfort and safety. And hip hop is about that kind of like unsettling, like we're going to provoke you and we're going to unsettle you. And when you have this safe kind of Will Smith type hip hop where it's like jiggy with it. And, there's a major critique of that. I'm really interested in like listening to No Malice's new album. He was in the rap duo Clips, which,
oh yeah,
very secular, you know, they rapped primarily about cocaine. And now he's a Christian. One half of the duo No Malice is a Christian. His new album, I think, just came out this week. So I'm interested in listening to it. It's just from my own like ongoing study and relationship to hip hop and how we appreciate it as Christians.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll leave it at this because I know we have to move on to other topics. But I think it was yesterday, I saw T-Pain linked to a video from Propaganda, the Christian hip hop artist, about the gospel. And it's just, there are a lot of like mixes that I just would not anticipate. I could point to other like secular hip hop artists that are listening to other Christian hip hop artists, but I'm not seeing the same thing in like the rock genre. So anyway, just an observation. I know we need to move on to movies or something.
Well, another podcast topic.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, we hope to open this up, and just to whet the appetite of the listeners, we do have some special surprises perhaps for episode 300 on this topic. Well, I'll leave it at that. But clearly with the music, we see a lot of similar things popping up here with how Christians can engage film or the cinema. And this is really a hot button issue, especially because now we add a visual element to this engaging in culture. That could be a big sticking point for a lot of people and raises some very serious questions about the types of movies that Christians can and should perhaps see. Brett, could you explain for us some of your background? You've done some graduate work in film, but also had some helpful, very useful experience in film criticism even before you've gone off to graduate school, correct?
Yeah, it's kind of been my specialty area, I guess you could say, in terms of cultural criticism. I had started writing movie reviews back when I was at Wheaton for the school newspaper, and got kind of started writing freelance for Relevant early on, even when I was in college. And then Christianity Today brought me on as a critic, film critic, soon after I graduated from Wheaton. And then, yeah, I went to graduate school at UCLA in their film school and in critical studies. So kind of the academic approach to film and television history and theory and criticism. So that was really an interesting thing for me. Having experience both on the Christian criticism side of things, writing film reviews from a Christian perspective and thinking about what that means, you know, what should a review, what should an engagement with a secular film look like from a Christian perspective and for a Christian audience. So like getting that perspective and then going to a very secular graduate master's program and getting the other extreme in terms of like, what is the secular academia say?
Yeah.
How should we approach film and the lens of, you know, of cultural studies and, you know, Marxism and all these other approaches that people, academics, like to take on things. So, yeah, that's kind of my background. And it's made me love film all the more. And I think the more I've learned to come to it with a critical eye and a perspective of, you know, just a deeply integrated perspective with my Christian faith, the more that I've appreciated it. And I feel like it's added a lot to my own spiritual walk.
What has been the range of responses you've had to your criticism, especially on CT, Christianity Today? How have people responded? Have you seen a spectrum of responses in relation to the types of movies that you've done reviews of?
Absolutely. It's always fun to read the comments because, yeah, there definitely are really positive people who are like, you know, yay, I'm so glad to see like actual, like thoughtful, in-depth, intelligent criticism on a Christian media website. But then, of course, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, why is CT even covering this film? Like, no Christian has any business watching a film like this. And it's, you know, it's just completely devoid of anything potentially valid or helpful for a Christian. And so, yeah, I've gotten used to it. And I think you can almost predict the comments based on the movie, like, because a lot of these people who comment, of course, they haven't seen the films and they're just, you know, basing their judgment on this maybe simplistic rubric of, well, there's, you know, the subject matter looks to contain a lot of violence or sex or whatever, so therefore it is completely invalid for a Christian to even watch it or engage it. So yeah, I mean that's kind of the one of the typical responses or approaches.
There's an entire section here on finding the line, and you offer five considerations for finding out whether or not something is over the line, whether or not you should engage in it. I'll let the listener pick this up, because there's some helpful guidelines here, about what your weaknesses are, the weaknesses in your community, whether or not this might be beneficial, etc. But I want to ask you particularly here about the value, if there is any, in being exposed to the darkness. Some people will cut themselves off entirely from certain violent themes or some things that might be depicted in film. But is there ever a value in exploring those issues through the cultural avenue of cinema?
Yeah. I mean, I think my answer to this question would kind of go for all art. I think that,
yeah,
you know, there is value in the darkness, and throughout the history of art, some of the most beautiful, moving art has been that which has focused our attention on, you know, some uncomfortable and difficult areas of our human experience. In the book, I quote a filmmaker, Akira Kurosawa, who's a great Japanese filmmaker, and he once said, "The artist is the one who does not look away." So when all of us kind of, almost we're hardwired to want to avoid certain things and not be confronted with certain things. But, you know, if the artist is the one willing to not look away, to actually focus our attention on, you know, the difficult areas, there can be value in that. Now, I do want to say that it can be taken too far, and there's certainly experiences where I've watched a film or, seen a TV show where I feel like the artist is wallowing in the darkness and is almost like fetishizing the darkness and celebrating it to an unhealthy extent. So I think there is a difference between kind of a healthy like exposure and a realistic just acknowledgement of the dark areas of our world, but then, you know, taking it to the point where you're just kind of celebrating it and giving the reader or the listener or the watcher no sense of hope or a reason why we can move out of it. But yeah, I mean, look at the Bible, look at the narrative of Scripture. Like, is there nothing dark there? Like, is the narrative of God's story in the world completely devoid of darkness? No, I mean, it's there, and it's part of our world, where there's this battle between good and evil and darkness and light. And as you know, as the people of light, as the carriers of that in this world, Christians shouldn't be naive to the dark, and we shouldn't just kind of hold our hands over our eyes and ears and just be ignorant of it. That's not to say that we need like rigorous, continual like education in the dark. I don't really buy the argument that like we need like to be exposed to dark all the time to remind us of it. You know, turn on the evening news once a week and you've got enough of a reminder of how fallen and dark our world is. But I think art has a unique ability to really connect with us on a deep soul level and orient us like to this grand drama of light and dark in tension with one another. And I don't want to keep going too much on this because I have a whole like theory of aesthetics that I could go into in terms, yeah. You know, good art needs tension, like music needs minor chords and resolution, and you know, painting needs light and dark, film needs protagonist and antagonist, conflict and resolution, story, narrative, all of it. It can't exist in just this perfect happy place where there's no tension or darkness. Within beauty resides this necessary attribute of tension, then I think we can start talking big picture about like the purpose of evil and darkness in the creation, in the world. Like maybe there's something to the value in darkness and God redeeming darkness because it creates this picture of light overcoming darkness. And yeah, so that's all I'll say about all of that.
Well, we'll have to table that for another discussion and expand on this aesthetic approach because it's important. And I do need to testify that, you know, that is replete throughout the book, that there's a lot of depth here. And we look forward maybe to explore that sometime in the future. Jared, you were saying?
Yeah, well, just to cap it off, I really appreciated that chapter in particular. Coming from like a philosophy background, there's so many parallels between someone's philosophy and then someone kind of portraying their own worldview philosophy in visual form for other people to consume in an aesthetic quality. So I need to do a lot more thinking about it, and the chapter really helped. But I guess transitioning, I know you have to go and we're running out of time, but we're coming full circle. The last section is on drinking, and of course this is a major hot topic. I found that to be very helpful, especially the five themes that you just go through in this last chapter, and I'll go through them quickly and maybe ask for just a little bit of comment. The theme number one is drunkenness is a sin. Theme number two is joy and blessing. Theme number three is eschatological symbol. Theme number four is that abstinence is a good option but not mandated. And theme number five is moderation. And I should say also that in the book, you have a lot of great personal experiences with each of these elements of drinking. But any closing thoughts on the drinking element that you'd like to communicate to people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just tying it just back to food and really with all these categories of Christian cultural consumption, with drinking, I think, you know, it kind of speaks to this idea that like creation is good. Like it is a good thing in itself. There's nothing evil, you know, innately, but it can become problematic. It can become an evil thing if we in our fallenness and with all of our disordered desires and proclivities to go wrong in different ways, if we take it you know, for example, if we take alcohol and get drunk with it or take it to excess, then it becomes a problem. It goes from something that connotes celebration and joy and eschatological blessing to something that throughout the Bible is associated with sin and people of the night and the dark, as opposed to children of light. So, yeah, I think the big point that I want to make just throughout the book is that these are good things and we should celebrate them and approach them in a posture of thankfulness and gladness. And we should seek to consume them in a manner of almost a posture of worship, wherein we see God's blessings and his characteristics and his truth and beauty in new ways. However, if we begin to consume them in unhealthy ways where it's filling some, you know, some need or some addiction or whatever, then they can become problematic. So that's exactly why these areas of culture have been so thorny throughout Christian history, is because they're so there's such potential for danger and hazard. But I think as Christians who have been given the fruit of the Spirit. We have self-control. We've been given these tools to help us wade through and navigate these areas. So rather than just avoid it altogether, which I think is like not only too safe and too easy of an answer, but it's also, I think, stripping ourselves of something that we were created to enjoy. So rather than doing that, things and really take our critical faculties that we've been given and approach these things, more thoughtfully, more critically, but also with more love and a desire to really get the most out of them.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And thank you for your well-balanced and critical thoughts about this topic. Again, the book we've been speaking about today, Gray Matters, Navigating the Space Between Legalism and Liberty, which is published by Baker Books. We'll have to have you back someday, Brett, and expand on some of these things. But thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule, especially in this season of life, to speak with us and to communicate these things to our listeners. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. And it was a pleasure. And I definitely will come back sometime.
Thanks. If you want to connect with Brett, you can through a number of different places. His personal blog is stillsearching.wordpress.com. You can connect with him on Twitter, in particular, at Brett McCracken. I do want to mention that we're available online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs as well as how to communicate with us. If you have any comments or questions or suggestions, tweet us at Reformed Forum or send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.